Welcome to another episode of the Guards Podcast. Today we have the privilege of speaking with Staff Sergeant Leif Anderson. We're going to dive right into experiences. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you have 15 years of military service under your belt, and while your primary duties are as an aircraft electrician and avionics supervisor, you still have racked up 1,200 flight hours in multiple models of the UH-60, which most people just generally call the Black Hawk helicopter. And you're a senior flight instructor for training new helicopter crew chiefs on the Black Hawk model here in Bismarck. Throw in a couple mobilizations, a handful of state activations for fires and flooding, and I'd say that's a pretty good recap, but definitely want to hear it from you. So what was that initial drive in your military background, and how did you come to actually join the National Guard? Because you didn't originally start in North Dakota.
You're right. I actually came from Minnesota. But first of all, I want to address one thing. You know, there's far more impressive people that work in Army Aviation North Dakota than I. I'm just lucky enough to come interview with you today and talk about my career, because I can only talk about what I do. But yeah, so I started in the Minnesota National Guard after college. And then eventually I did an interstate transfer in IST to North Dakota, because I took a job here in North Dakota working in law enforcement in Western North Dakota. Technically, I guess my first job in the Army was a 15 Foxtrot. I was an aircraft electrician, so I was qualified to work on Chinooks, Blackhawks, and Cobras, which we don't have anymore, but they were kind of phasing those out. And then later on, when I moved to North Dakota, they had too many aircraft electricians in their units. So, hey, we need aircraft mechanics, Blackhawk mechanics. So I went to 15 Tango School later on. And then over the years, I've used my two MOSs to move around in aviation to support the unit and find promotions. But before 2013, I was trained up to be a Blackhawk crew chief on one of the deployments you mentioned. And what a Blackhawk crew chief does instead of a mechanic is they work with the flight crews in the back of the aircraft to perform flight tasks for the pilots. Some of their jobs are pretty important when we're talking about doing sling loads or water buckets, moving passengers safely in and out of the aircraft. Crew chiefs are pretty vital for air assault missions, inserting troops or people. And sometimes VIP movements. The crew chief is the face of the unit, and they're the one that renders a salute to the colonel or general that climbs on board.
So you were born originally in Northeast Minneapolis, and you graduated from with a law enforcement degree from Alexandria Technical College in Minnesota. What initially drew you to law enforcement, and when you graduated in the spring of 2009, it was a pretty difficult hiring time for a lot of people. So
it was at the time we were kind of in a recession. So I got through college and I was very optimistic, and I went through all the credentialing to become licensed, and I was having a hard time getting a job. But yes, why did I join? Why did I pursue law enforcement? Honestly, in high school I was terrible at math. There's not a lot of math in law enforcement. I mean, there's simple math, but we're not doing theoretical math like trigonometry and calculus. And I really struggled with that. And I knew that in any other major that I was interested in, such as engineering, that was going to be something I would have to accomplish. So I was like, hey, we're looking at some classes I probably am not going to pass or I'd really, really struggle with. So I went and found something else that I thought I'd be good at, and which was talking to people. I mean, that's really what police officers do, is they interact with the public. And then, honestly, the law enforcement has a lot of discipline involved. You know, you have to appear a certain way. You have to act a certain way. You have to remain professional. And that was kind of a challenge I wanted to rise to. But, you know, at the time, if I go back a little further, at the time I was working for a construction company, and the boss, who was a Marine Corps veteran, Vietnam veteran, he received Purple Heart in Vietnam. I respected the guy immensely. But I worked for him for a couple of years, and he says, hey, come January, you're not going to have a job here. And so I had a pretty big choice to make that fall. So I enrolled in college, and I started spring semester, and that's kind of how it kicked off. He forced my hand to go do something with myself. And I'm grateful for that push, because I think he saw something in me that at the time I didn't see in myself. Eventually, I graduated college, went through all the things that you need to do to be credited as a police officer, and then I entered the job pool, or the applicant pool, to try and get a job. And at the time, like I said, the economy wasn't great. There wasn't a lot of government jobs to be had. And so I remember sitting down being one of 80 to 100 to 120 applicants. And a lot of the guys would look around the waiting room and are suit and tie with their resumes were the same guys we're seeing over and over, or they were former classmates from college also looking for jobs. And so at the time, Minnesota was kind of hard. It was hard to get jobs. Time went on. I kept working. I was living with my girlfriend at the time, and we were kind of splitting rent and other things. I was working two, if not three jobs. I worked in a warehouse running a forklift for just about minimum wage. I had a really cool job working at a fancy hotel, parking cars, right outside of a nightclub. That was kind of a really fun job. I didn't pay much working overnights. It was a lot of work. And I remember the itchy wool pants. We had to wear a dress uniform and run around in dress shoes. But just trying to make ends meet, it was very difficult. And so eventually I kind of went back to the idea of, like, hey, you know, the military is still an option. I was a young, fit individual, didn't have a criminal record. So it would be pretty easy to get into the military if I tried. One of my classmates was a recruiter in Minnesota. So I approached him, like, hey, I'm thinking about joining the military. And I had a lot of friends that were vets in college, and we talked about, I've entertained the idea a little bit, but my recruiter set me up, and eventually I went off to basic training. The rest is history. So here I am.
No, yeah, it's definitely one of those things where the journey to the new career doesn't always line up the way you think it does.
Yeah, and then I had a law enforcement background. People like, why didn't you go to be an MP? And, you know, I had some advice and wisdom from my father. He's like, hey, you need a different job. You need to get some military training that's different than what you already have, just kind of have something to fall back on. And he was very right.
Yeah, that way you have two different prongs. You know, you have the electrician background and then for aircraft, and then, okay, I still have my credentials to be a law enforcement officer,
right,
if I want to.
You know?
So, and that's what ultimately brought you to North Dakota, right, was that law enforcement background.
Correct. Yep. Eventually I took a job in Western North Dakota, and I was working on the oil field for a county sheriff's office. And I was – you talk about two polar opposites. I was a kid growing – I grew up in the city. Right. You know, I had exposure to rural living. You know, I had family in outlying Minnesota, but going from a big city to rural Western North Dakota was a huge culture shock for me in many ways. Just the challenges of living by myself in the middle of nowhere, you know. And at the time, again, a little economic background, the oil field was heavily inflated because of the wages. And so I was a public servant, not earning much money. It was difficult to find a home that had affordable rent. The house I lived in was this old farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, and I think the rancher, the farmer that owned it, kind of took pity on me. You know, I think he was supportive because he's like, hey, I got a cop living in my old house. This will be good. He's not going to trash the place. But at the same time, the house needed work. And but I remember one morning, and this is kind of a funny story, one morning I woke up, and I was taking a shower, and the shower just shut off. I was, you know, all lathered up with soap and soap in my hair. I was like, oh, no, I got soap in my eyes. I get out, you know, grab a towel, figure out what's going on. I walk out in the kitchen. I check the faucet, see if the kitchen's working. And I look up the kitchen window, and there's about 100, 200 head of cattle at the wellhead drinking out of the stock pond. What had happened is they were pulling water off the pond, and the float came up and decided to fill that pond again. And I lost pressure in the house off the well. So I knew that if I wanted to take a shower, I had to get up before the cows did. To use a shower. There's nothing I could do about that. That was just the way of life.
Yeah, so not something you normally deal with. In a...
Yeah, I had rabbit ears on my TV, so I had local TV. I didn't have internet. I didn't have a landline phone. You know, I think I had a BlackBerry. So like, what you take for granted now, I didn't have any of that. I think I was still getting Netflix in the mail. Like, you used to order discs. Like, that was my form of entertainment.
Yeah, get the good old DVD sent to you.
Yeah, yeah. And then at night, you'd have the TV sign off, you know, saying thanks for watching. And they'd play, you know, God Bless America and show the American flag.
So then we talked about you moving over to North Dakota, and eventually you started doing full-time work with the North Dakota National Guard after your interstate transfer. How did that come to be?
Yeah, so I was in Bismarck at the facility where we have our aircraft, and one of the gentlemen there, he left of a temporary position, and I was splitting drill, or AT. I was making up time because I was working shift work. I wasn't always able to make my drill requirements. So I was making up some drill, and a job opening presented itself, and I thought this would be pretty cool. And at the time, the law enforcement job was kind of weighing on me. I kind of had a lonely, unhealthy lifestyle where I was at, and I needed a change. So eventually I moved to Bismarck, and I started working there full-time, and it's been about 12 years now since I've done that. somebody there saw something in me that I was doing a good job, so they kept me around, and I've been working there ever since.
Awesome. No, yeah, that sounds great. The, you know, a little change of pace and keep moving around and join up in Bismarck. So during that time, too, you were doing that for a little bit, and then a deployment came up to go to Kosovo.
Yeah, I think it was about 2013. I was with 285th, and I just was trained with to be a crew chief, and they needed crew chiefs on this deployment to go to Kosovo. And we were stationed, when we got to Kosovo, we were stationed in Camp Bonsteel. And there's a lot of people in North Dakota that have been to Kosovo. I think there's been maybe three or four different units that have gone through rotation. I know three in our aviation battalion have gone through there. We were part of like a large task force, you know, American presence. And then we were also part of a NATO task force, a NATO group. That was, our job was to promote peace, obviously, and then production of new government so that they could be a self-sustaining nation.
Any big highlights from that, or like training that you got to do while you're there, or any important operations you got to take part in?
We had the opportunity to work with a lot of other countries. Poland, there's a lot of Polish Navy. VIP movements is pretty frequent. It was actually faster to fly in that country than it was to drive or take a train, just because the infrastructure wasn't there. So to drive, you know, an hour, you maybe only go 30 miles. So it was easier to get an aircraft and make an 8-minute flight north to another NATO base so all the leadership could have their meetings. But the kind of cool part about that, being a flight crew, is we were able to take the VIPs to their meetings, but afterwards we would kind of be idle for a while. We'd have nothing to do. So we'd cruise around the French post or the German post, or, you know, there's a couple other multinational posts, and we would go get coffee, or we'd dine at their DFAC and we'd try their customary foods. You know, I remember eating rabbit at the Hungarian DFAC. And everywhere we went, we were welcomed pretty well as being Americans, especially even the local nationals. They were for the most part pretty happy to have us there, and they're very supportive of us. And I gotta say this, and if anybody remembers who's been to Kosovo, if you ever had a macchiato in Kosovo or their coffee, that is something that's still unmatched. And my wife kind of teases me because I'm always on the hunt to find a macchiato that is as good, if not better, than what I had in Kosovo, and I still haven't found one yet.
Yeah, I think that's one of the funny parts is you ask most people about Kosovo, and that's, they'd also give larger servings of those drinks, because yes, normally it's like, you know, a little shot of espresso and some foam,
right?
But they're like, well, Americans aren't used to this, so like we have to put more milk into it, because it needs to be like, not, it needs to be like a drink that they can sip on for like 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah, or I was introduced to real Turkish coffee. We were invited by the we're invited by soldiers from Turkey to, you know, dine with them, and they had real, you know, tea and coffee, and it was pretty robust. In fact, they watered it down for us because it was too bold.
Yeah, they're like, this is rather thick. What am I drinking here?
Yeah, but that's funny. Like, your military service, you never expect to go places and experience these things, but that's kind of the funny stuff you remember. And I think maybe it's because you grasp onto things that are that remind you of home, right? You got to have that comfort when you can't find it, which is why I think a lot of soldiers, when they leave home and they go off together as a group or a unit, they connect a little bit more, because they all kind of embrace the suck, so to speak, right? You've heard that term before. And so that we build a camaraderie with each other, which I didn't. You know, going back to when I first got on the guard, I joined the unit in Minnesota, and they just came back from Iraq. And it was very difficult to connect with them, but they had that connection from being deployed in Iraq. And I didn't understand why until I had deployed myself. And I come home, and I kind of saw that in ourselves with some of the new soldiers that showed up to our unit that weren't on the deployment. And I remembered to put myself in their shoes, like, hey, some things they're just going to know about, some things are not. But you got to remember to kind of welcome them in, too, because they're part of the team.
Yeah, definitely wanted to, like, all right, we need to open up the circle. Like, all right, we spent the last 9 months together somewhere. Like, we're very tight, but we need to bring these new people into the circle.
Right, because you want them to succeed. You want them to be part of your group. You want to trust them. And eventually, you know, old sergeants like myself, we're going to move on and retire, and it's going to be their program. So they got to learn the ropes and understand what we do.
Yeah, so my last question about Kosovo is, was aviation still rocking the Waffle House when you were there?
We did actually. So up there, that for your listeners out there, if you guys know what a clamshell hangar is, basically it's a glorified tent that has winches that open the ends, and they were huge. They're almost like stadium like tents, and we'd park our aircraft in it. Well, on the side of this clamshell hangar, there was a plywood structure that was whitewashed, and they had waffle irons. I think we even had a sink and some other mixing equipment. And then every Sunday morning, it was tradition. Like, other nations would get in a bus and travel to Camp Bondsteel. Like, other NATO countries would send their soldiers. And what we'd do is we would raise money for local programs. One of the big ones was TOEFL, which was an English entry exam, or an English exam assessment that the local high school kids, or the kids at the university, they call it, would take. And they would try to score high so they could get college entry, or they could enroll in colleges like, say, Germany or the UK or US. And then what's amazing about that, I'm in a little tangent here, but what's amazing about that is those kids always wanted to come back. Majority of them said, we want to go to college and come back and then make our country better. But yeah, they still had Waffle House. And we did that the whole time we were there. And I think a lot of people really look forward to the Waffle House. You know, when you're on a base where you have a DFAC, you know, dining facility, and you already know what the weekly menu is going to be, and you have like no, almost no choice in what you eat, which is another reason why we look forward to getting off post and flying places, because we could diversify our menu. But we didn't always have oranges, apples, and bananas. So I remember wearing a flight jacket in the summertime, just stuff my pockets with fruit to bring it back. But the Waffle House kind of broke up the monotony of things, even though it was every Sunday. It was also a meeting place, socialize, you know. Here in town, you go to the cafe or you go to the bar and hang out with your friends. It was another opportunity to just not work and enjoy a luxury of food that wasn't made in a facility.
Yeah, just a more relaxing Sunday morning.
Right.
Take a walk. Let's go grab some waffles. Let's hang out and talk to people. And it's interesting, you know, you talk about going to the other DFACs of nations, and they're like, okay, we want to go get some of those American waffles.
You know, we kind of had the luxury of doing that. So we would oftentimes get pizzas and bring them back. And we'd bring them to the fuelers and the operations people that couldn't leave post. Like, we had the luxury, too. So always looking out for other people.
So bringing it back to, you know, stateside operations, you've been involved in numerous emergency response efforts in North Dakota. We're talking, you know, wildfires, flooding, train derailments. So pretty much a lot of events in the last decade that have happened, you've been involved because aviation was involved. What can you tell me about some of those?
Some of that is just by proximity, you know, or just luck. There's a lot of people I work with at our facility that we're just there. We're there Monday through Friday, you know. And a lot of times we get the call, we're already there. Sometimes all I have to do is change my boots, grab some flight gear, prep for the mission, and we're out the door. It's sometimes that quick. A lot of it, or some of it's staging. We think something's going to happen, so we prepare our equipment, and or we're on standby. So that's honestly, I'm just lucky, I guess. And then a lot of times, you know, I've been doing this a long time, so we want to put our, you know, me and a lot of other soldiers there, been doing this for a long time, so we put our A game, you know, you want to put your A team together so that you're successful, you know, or you get the best set of eyes on whatever's going on so that you can have a better assessment going forward. And obviously, you know, our commanders and our leadership, we want to give the best effort for our bosses.
Yeah, speaking of, you know, so you said being on standby.
Yes.
One of the most recent ones we had was the wildfires in October of 2024.
Right.
So you guys were on standby, prepped and ready to go when they thought something might happen.
Yeah, historically, we kind of watch fire conditions. So if we know there's going to be red flag warnings, or if the drought is getting higher and there's an opportunity for high winds, we just know it's going to happen. So we may not necessarily tell everybody that, but we usually get things ready and understand that that is a possibility. Kind of like watching the river. The river goes up, we know it's going to flood, or there's a likelihood of flooding. So, but we kind of watched that. I was put on standby, or we got crews together to go on standby, rather. And I remember just watching the news and watching the weather. And before this recent bout of fires, we just watched the wind pick up, and it got worse, and it got worse, and more wind and more wind, and like, this is not good. And the fires kicked off. And if you go on any fire tracking website, there's a lot of government agencies that do that. We were watching all the same stuff everybody else was, and watching the news. And then we got our information from people on the ground. And then a day after, I suppose, or 2 days later, things kind of settled down. We got a grasp on things, and we're able to launch aviation assets, because we have limits. We can't necessarily fly into 100 mile an hour wind and then be successful with, you know, a 6-ton water bucket underneath the aircraft. It just doesn't work that way.
So what was some of the things you were doing? So, like, some of the fires you responded to, like, take through that process of, like, what does aviation do when responding to a wildfire?
So really, we're not taking point by any means, but a lot of times we're asked to do things because we have a better vantage point. You know, we're in the air. We constantly have big picture, whereas a guy on the ground can only see the brush in front of him or over the next hill. From our vantage point high above the ground, we can see pretty much how the fire is moving. It's a pretty dynamic scene. And a lot of us aviators or in aviation have fought fires before. I mean, this isn't the first fire we've had in the States. We fought a fire at UMary. I think it was like 2012, 13. Actually, 2015, if I remember right. And there was a Medora fire. I think it was 2021. I wasn't there for that one, but we have a lot of experience so fighting fires. So not that we're aviators. We're not necessarily firefighters, but we have experience firefighting. And then we work with the state teams and the local teams and train that every year. So we come prepared. So we have some idea. We also understand the language. A firefighter speak a different language than we do. And so we have to learn and adapt and communicate in the way that they speak to us.
And that's definitely a team effort because, like you said, like you guys aren't running point, but there's people communicating on the ground.
100%. You've got guys that are walking, wearing the green pants, the yellow shirts with the hard hats. You can see those guys walking. And sometimes you can't see them, so we got to find them. But you see those guys on the ground. They got engines, which is basically a truck that hauls water. They got tankers that are out there. Dozers, heavy equipment we've seen. And then a lot of times there's other air assets that they'll bring in large airplanes. You know, it'll look like a commercial airliner, and then all of a sudden it just dumps red flame retardant at the bottom. You know, it's something pretty cool to see this last fall. I understand it was a lot of damage and devastation, but to watch this big, you know, jet airliner drop under the horizon, which is not normal, and then climb out, and then this fire retardant sprays everywhere. That was a pretty cool scene to see. So ground guys, trucks, heavy equipment, helicopters. There's other aircraft we saw out in those wildfires. There's civilian or other government agencies. And then big aircraft. And then there's a joint controller. There's a guy in a plane flying around over the top of everything, kind of organizing things while those big planes are on scene. And then when they leave, we're kind of in charge again, working with the ground crews, and then all work together to attack the head of a fire or... we work on hot spots, which is just a fire that could spread potentially.
Yeah, so it's definitely like building that stack of people. Like, here's the people on the ground. Here's the people at low altitude. Here's another plane.
What's crazy is most of us have never met. I mean, I've met a few of the leadership in our state because we train with them. But for the most part, I've never met these guys on the ground. So you just have to immediately trust what they're telling you. And sometimes we just have to get clarification that we're doing the right thing.
So definitely... with so much, you know, state activation, working the active duty mission for the state of North Dakota, like, what do you find most rewarding about taking part in those?
I've given this some thought, you know, because I've been asked this question before, and really what it is in the military, you train to go do something in a faraway land, right? A lot of military services train you up to do that. The cool part of being in the National Guard is you're literally helping Americans in their backyard, right? You're helping Americans in their pasture with a problem they immediately have. Which is not necessarily the same shared experience that active duty component has. So that's pretty unique to the National Guard. So that in itself is really rewarding because I have participated. So, for example, earlier in 2024, there was a ice jam on the Missouri River here in Bismarck, Mandan, right? And then we're very close to the shores of that river, and there's people out there with cameras. You can see the people that live there, and they're watching you do it, and they're shaking their hands up and down, cheering you on. You know, in reality, what we're doing, we don't think is necessarily always effective, you know, because we can see the whole thing. Like, we're just a small tool working a small problem right now. But when you look down and you see these American citizens cheering you on, like, hey, the local North Dakotans that are here, cheering you on, and then later on you might be somewhere else and like, hey, you're in aviation, right? Like, yeah, I'm in aviation. And like, well, were you in the helicopter over the river? It's like, well, yes, I was. And like, oh, well, that's so awesome. You know, my neighbor said you guys like saved their house. You know, we don't necessarily put the direct correlation, and maybe we did or didn't save their house, but there's that immediate, you know, satisfaction that we're helping someone.
You know, talking about a lot of state activity that you've taken part in. But if we move in, you originally started your military career to basically make ends meet. But you said that's changed over time. And I think that's like job gratification has taken over that. Like, So what else has continued to influence you to just keep serving, keep doing what you're doing?
Yeah, you know, I started off, I wanted a job. I didn't want to move with my parents. So I was like, oh, I'll go National Guard. And then, honestly, it was one opportunity after another. One opportunity was, you know, go to a military school. And by having that credential from the military school, it opened up another opportunity for a different position. And it just kept growing and growing. And what I'll say, and I don't know why necessarily I'm successful, but if I had to put any thought into it, it would be that given an opportunity, if you put in the hard work and you study and try to know as much as you can about that topic at the time or become the subject matter expert that you needed to be in your position, you will be successful. And it was just basically chasing one opportunity after another. And then also teamwork, right? I can't be successful by myself. I had to learn all this from somebody. And then also there's a lot of very smart minds in our organization. So it's basically seeking out those people and finding out what they know. Because, like I said, we're not all going to be here forever. We're going to retire eventually, so you got to grab onto that knowledge before they leave. Yep. And that would basically be, you know, mentorship. You know, you got to find a good mentor to be successful. So I started off about money, and then it was opportunities, and then it kind of grew into a career, and then that career had security. You know, I was able to earn a good wage, earn a good living, and then have, you know, some stability to have a mortgage and, you know, successfully raise children and have a good life.
Yeah, so essentially you're talking about, you know, building the bench of people.
Right.
Of like to you know, progress forward because we're not all going to be around here forever.
Let's be honest. I don't want to do this forever, right? I'm going to get old and tired and maybe eventually I might get bored of it, but I want to pass it on to somebody else so that I don't have to do this forever. And they can learn from my mistakes, you know, lessons I learned, experiences.
So what advice would you give someone then that's, you know, thinking about a career in the National Guard similar to like what you did or something else?
If you're physically able and you can leave home to go experience this, because it's a considerable commitment, right? You're going to leave home to go do basic training. You leave home to go AIT. There's always likelihood that the U.S. government could send you someplace you don't want to be, right? That's a likelihood in the military. And we got volumes of movies about this and TV shows, so it's not a secret. But I would say is if you are physically able and you have a positive spirit and you're not attached so much where you can't leave home, I would say try it. You know, right now they're looking at, what, a 6+2 commitment, so 6 years plus two inactive. That's how I started. That's how most people start their careers in the National Guard. Some people I know transitioned and went active duty. They liked it enough where they wanted to do this full time, and they wanted a PCS and move to different countries around the world, and that was something they wanted. I know some people start off in the Army and end up going Air Force, and Air Force to Army, and Marine Corps to Army. So, but you don't have that opportunity unless you walk into a recruiting office like, hey, this is what I want to do. What can you offer me? And then, honestly, I have a really cool job. And if I'm going to pound my chest a little bit, like all of my peer group that I grew up with, I don't know anybody that does what I do, right? There's the select amount of people I work with day to day, but even then we're a very, very small community. So if you work hard and you show up to work on time and you stay late when you're needed, because that's what it takes to get the job done, you'll be successful.
Yeah. So basically you're talking about the recruiter's office. So something that sparked your interest was you were mentioned, you know, offline, basically right, sitting in a vet center, listening to people talk.
Yeah. So I would sneak in the vet center with my buddy who, if he's listening, he knows who he is. And we'd study, and it was a pretty exclusive group, right? I wasn't supposed to be in there because I wasn't a veteran. I was just a regular student at the time. And these guys were probably in their 30s, somewhere in their 40s already. They had done time in Iraq and Afghanistan, Kosovo, you know. But I would sit and listen to them. They'd tell stories about their time in the service. And it wasn't always like gory war stories. It was just funny stuff that happened, you know. And a lot of that revolved around just being in the military, your militaryisms, right? But they're a pretty cool group of guys and gals. But one thing that stood out to me is they all conveyed this confidence, right? It was a very attractive feature. And when you're a young, impressionable man, like, you want that, right? You want to feel cool. You want to be attractive. And so that kind of stuck out to me. And the other thing was they were all strangers, right? They all came from different places. I think maybe a couple of them knew each other from somewhere, but for the most part, they were all strangers, and they all kind of immediately connected because they had that experience of maybe hardship in the military or overcoming something because of the military. And then, honestly, it was just kind of fun hanging out there hearing the stories because they always tease each other and jokes in such a way. It was funny. So I just sat there and I listened, and I didn't really say much. But I thought that was really cool. I wanted what they had. They had a feeling of belonging. They had a feeling of pride in this overwhelming accomplishment. And, you talk about my career and my service, and I don't know if I've gotten there yet, but I could definitely mention some moments that would make me feel that way.
Awesome. So, yeah, I think that's a great, stopping point for us today. Biggest thing I want to ask for you, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you wanted to talk about, or is there any message you want to share with people listening out there?
I've had a pretty big career, but I've been able to work with a lot of different countries. I've worked with some special groups, being in aviation, pretty high profile, and we have the vehicle they need to do their jobs. I've got to work in Kosovo and Canada, the United States. I've got to see a lot of the United States from the backseat of an aircraft. You know, flying 300 feet across Wyoming is pretty cool, but also seeing, the city of Dallas, landing at the Pentagon, I got some awesome stories about working in the National Capital Region, D.C. I would say in 15 years, I've missed quite a few of my children's birthdays, anniversaries because I'm away. That kind of sticks out with me because my family is a huge support in what I do, and I definitely owe them for my absence. And then them supporting me in everything that I do to be successful in the military, because that is a huge piece. You can't do this by yourself. I got to fly Blackhawks across the United States and see America from 300 to 500 feet. That's pretty awesome. Got to fly around the Washington, D.C. area. And with that, I was able to witness a dignified transfer, remains at Dover Air Force Base. That was pretty humbling to be there for that. Coming home from Kosovo, I remember stopping at Shannon, Ireland, an airport. And we're all going home, and at the time, but one of the profound things that kind of stuck out to me about that moment is there was a warrant officer. His name is a CW2 Smith. Very generic name, I know, but I know who he is. But he sat down at the piano. There's a grand piano kind of in the middle of this airport terminal, and it got deadly. It just got quiet. It just got silent. And he so elegantly played this grand piano, because I think everybody knew that they were going home. Like, there was this moment where they're going to go home and see their families again, and that what we just done was over. And then maybe with some of the sadness, because these people we got connected with, we may not see again. But the Army's a small world. We usually run into each other eventually. One thing about living overseas, it gave me a new perspective about, honestly, how great the United States of America is. We take a lot of things for granted, and I do appreciate living in the United States, having experienced other parts of the world. And then, really, I'm not really as successful as I'd be without working with a great group of professionals. You know, a lot of support comes from them, a lot of confidence from them in what I do. And so it's definitely a team effort. And like I said, I'm not the most interesting Army aviator, or the most experienced guy we have in the state of North Dakota. And I want that to be known.
No, definitely somebody we could have on in the future too. We'd reach out and get some more aviators.
I'll give a list of names.
So we can take that down. So awesome. Hey, thank you so much for joining us today. Everybody, you're listening to Staff Sergeant Leif Anderson. We hope you enjoyed learning about his journey and his experiences. Make sure you follow us on our social media accounts. And if there's anyone else you'd like to hear on the podcast, sounds like we're probably going to have some more aviators in the near future.
I think so. You should.
But if anybody else wants to hear anyone in the North Dakota National Guard, please just shoot us a message on any of our social media accounts, and we'll get back to it.
Well, thanks for having me today.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us.